Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network and New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, coming to you from the University of Texas at Austin. And it's my great pleasure today to interview historian Dr. Catherine Gibson, who is a historian of modern Eastern Europe and a research fellow of the University of Tartu in Estonia. She is a specialist in the history of geography and cartography, and today we'll be talking about her new book, just out with Oxford University Press, called Geographies of Nationhood, Cartography, Science, and Society in the Russian Imperial Baltic 2022. Catherine, thanks so much for being on the podcast with me here today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So I want to start with a question that I really love to ask of all authors, and I understand this is your first book, so we have an eager listenership, I think, who would love to hear about what motivated you. So what was it that got you interested in maps and in this topic?
Well, I think for many of us who are interested in maps, they hold a certain fascination as visual and material objects. They're something that we encounter frequently in everyday life, in textbooks, in museums, and now also widely shared on social media. And when it comes to ethnographic maps in particular, the way that these are presented and discussed is often highly political, used as a source of national pride, and also to bolster different kind of imperialist claims to different peoples and territories. But these also raised key questions for me. Whenever I see a map, I immediately kind of want to know more. Who made the map? Under what circumstances was it produced? Who funded it? Where and how was it printed? And who was the intended audience? And what did they think of it? So these are all about kind of providing historical context to maps. And I think this is kind of a crucial question that we have to ask ourselves to understand, you know, really what it is that we are looking at. So I embarked on this project to try and understand why people in the past invested so much time, energy, and money into making these maps. Whether this was a static genre or whether the meaning of making a map changed from the first decades of the 19th century up to the early 20th century. And ultimately, to try and answer the question of why these maps came to be regarded as such impactful forms of visual communication. When it comes to defining different groups, communities, and drawing borders between them.
Mm-hmm. And so I'd actually like to begin as well with the scope of your book, since you mentioned context. I'm very interested in the time and space dimension of geographies of nationhood. And I noticed in reading it that you're focusing mainly on Baltic countries. So it's Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which I would guess were in Imperial Russia once provinces, Estland, Livland, and Courland. Could you give us a little orientation about the time and space dimension within the book, these provinces, these countries, the contestations between nations and states?
Sure. So my book focuses on the Baltic provinces of the Russian Empire, which today form part of the territories of Estonia and Latvia. In the 19th century, they were widely known by their German names as Estland, Livland, and Courland, or also in Russian as the governorates of Estlandskaya, Livlandskaya, and Courlandskaya. This region had been partially ruled by Sweden, and the northern sections, so Estland and Livland, were transferred to the Russian Empire in the early 18th century, whereas the province of Courland, which is today in southern Latvia, had been a vassal of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and then was incorporated into the Russian Empire at the end of the 18th century. So while these three provinces had quite distinctive histories, the region collectively became known as the Baltic provinces within the Russian Empire. And although they were incorporated into the empire, they retained quite a distinctive character and status. They were characterized by a German-speaking elite class who were known as Baltic Germans, the manorial economy system. The region maintained a degree of autonomy over local governance. It had a special code of laws and also was distinguished from the rest of the empire by the majority Lutheran faith of the population. The lower classes, the peasants, were mostly Estonian or Latvian speakers, although there was also significant numbers of Russian speakers, Jews, as well as Old Believers and Poles, especially in the southeastern part of Courland. So what makes this region really interesting is that this complex history and multiculturalism, multi-confessionality means that the region was situated at the crossroads of various imperial and nation-building projects in the 19th century. We have Russian imperialism, and especially after the 1880s, during the period of so-called intensified Russification policies, there was attempts to really try and integrate this region more closely with the rest of the empire. At the same time, you also had attempts by the local Baltic Germans to also try and define their relationship to the empire, as well as their locality, the idea of this Baltic region being their Heimat, their homeland, and also their relationship to other groups of German speakers in Central Europe. And then we also have emerging Estonian and Latvian nationalist movements as well as the various other groups as well within the region. And what I really wanted to try and do by focusing on this region was that whereas I felt that today's territories of Lithuania, Belarus, Poland, and Ukraine have really been at the center of much excellent research on spatial history, on new imperial history that has emerged over the past decades, the Baltic provinces have actually been surprisingly absent from some of these wider conversations. I think perhaps on the one hand, this is due to the kind of the autonomy that I've just mentioned, the kind of particular status of the Baltic provinces, which has led to them, historiographically speaking, to be kind of treated separately, a bit like the Grand Duchy of Finland. Another reason might also be issues of language and sources, since for most of the 19th century, much material is in German, and historians who kind of specialize on the Russian Empire don't always have German language. It's not a given. So my aim in kind of writing this book, in focusing on the Baltic, was really to see how we can integrate the Baltic provinces into some of these wider conversations about imperial borderlands in Eastern Europe, but also to draw attention to how some of the particularities of the Baltic region can help challenge and push our understanding of Russian imperial history further and in new directions.
Mm-hmm. I want to pick up on a couple of those comments. First, simply to congratulate you on this kind of breadth of a project, because the linguistic challenges are so daunting. And I noticed that you have archives that are in German as well as Estonian and Latvian and Russian. So my question for you, Catherine, would be if you could explain to us a little bit more about this history of ethnography and these artifacts, the maps, ethnographic maps and map makers. There are many of these original maps that you've included, and Oxford University Press has done a good job reproducing them. But maybe you can tell us a little bit more about this tradition of ethnographic map making from, say, the 1830s and 40s up to and through World War I. Were the conventions in the Baltic, say, different from Habsburg lands or Central European lands, and what made it so?
Great questions. So the genre of the ethnographic map arose, we can say, in the kind of late 1830s, 1840s, out of German-speaking Central Europe, this kind of intellectual milieu, we can say, to kind of try and understand various nationalities questions that was emerging. In my book, I try and show how many of the kind of key figures within the Russian Academy of Sciences and Imperial Russian Geographical Society were intimately embedded in these networks. Many of them were so-called Russian Germans, so Russian imperial subjects who had German ancestry or were from German-speaking families. And they were part of this kind of vast trans-imperial network of scholars who were all experimenting with how to use geographical methods, how to use methods of data visualization to understand questions of imperial diversity and nationalities questions. Where we see the Russian Empire, the kind of history of ethnographic mapping in the Russian Empire going in a different direction, so to speak, is that in the second half of the 1840s, the very first ethnographic maps that were produced within the Russian Empire, a project which was spearheaded by Peter von Koppen, who was a statistician and a member of the Imperial Russian Geographical Society. And together with his colleague, Karl Ernst von Baer, who is head of the ethnographic section at the Imperial Russian Geographical Society, they were really interested in using ethnographic mapping to understand and map the empire's Finno-Ugric populations. So this was very... very much rooted in the kind of 18th century practices of ethnography in the Russian Empire, which was about exploring often the northern regions of the empire. And this translated also into ethnographic mapping. So this is why we see in the second half of the 1840s, the first ethnographic maps produced in the Russian Empire were of places like the Grand Duchy of Finland, of St. Petersburg province. There was interest as well in the Baltic provinces, these regions that were close to St. Petersburg, but inhabited by Finno-Ugric populations. So this, we can say, was a kind of convention or a kind of more distinctive Russian imperial approach to the genre. Moving forward to think of the kind of second half of the 19th century, I see less and less distinction there emerging. We see the same kind of tensions between the use of ethnographic maps to map various kind of emerging national territories within empires, and also more kind of expansive attempts to kind of map communities of Slavic peoples and Germanic peoples as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that a little bit. And again, just for our listening audience, because I can't possibly do justice to all of the chapters, Dr. Gibson has five chapters in the book. So the first is Networks of Cartographic Influence, Patronage, and Reception. Second, on map production in the provinces and the rise of cartographic entrepreneurship. Third, the Baltic question in the cartographic imagination. Fourth, mapping Latvians in local and global perspectives. Fifth, post-war ethnic boundary mapping from above and below. And, you know, as a way maybe to cover some of this, and I guess really what amazes me is this Finno-Ugric dimension incorporated into imperial geographic science. I wonder if you could say a little bit more, introduce to our readers the names of these statisticians, census takers, borderlands monitors, and ultimately, you know, the people who acquire the talent to draw, to do what we now call data viz, but to put together these maps. And you know, you're shifting the attention, I think, here from cartographers to map makers, and this is a very interesting move. Maybe you could tell us some of their names, and not just Russians or Russian Baltic Germans, but eventually some of the other Baltic peoples, Latvians and Belarusians and so forth, who become involved in this process.
Yes. So as you kind of mentioned, one of the things, the kind of concepts I was working with the book was to look at map makers rather than kind of these well-known geographical superstars that we might be aware of if we are familiar with kind of history of science in the Russian Empire, but to really look at those who engaged in different processes of map making and of map production, but who may not have been self-titled or even thought of themselves as cartographers or map makers per se. So, as you mentioned, in the second chapter, I'm interested in the role of local bureaucrats and also entrepreneurs, cartographic entrepreneurs and printing houses. So this chapter centers on the figure of Alexander Sementovsky, who was actually born in what is today Ukraine, but as was quite typical for kind of Russian imperial civil servants at the time, he served in various different provinces. And where I pick up his story is in the 1860s and 1870s, when he was secretary of Vitebsk Provincial Statistical Committee. And Semyontovsky is an interesting figure because while today he is primarily known as an ethnographer of Belarus, of Belarusian language and kind of folk culture, among contemporaries, he actually developed quite a strong reputation for his enthusiasm for mapping statistical data. But his name doesn't really make it into the kind of history of cartography in the Russian Empire per se, because despite his efforts to try and publish a statistical atlas of Vitebsk province, his work was hampered by the limited budget, logistical challenges of trying to commission a printer in St. Petersburg to publish his maps at a time when the kind of local printing infrastructure in Vitebsk there wasn't the necessary technology or skilled personnel to kind of realize his map vision. So actually most of his mapping projects never came to fruition, but this didn't mean that he was trying and he was working behind the scenes. And I think his is a really interesting example because it makes us aware of the maps that we have today that are in archives, that have been preserved in library catalogs, are only a very small proportion of the total kind of cartographic activity and cartographic print culture and interest in cartography that was circulating at the time. And it makes us self-reflect also on how the archival or library record reflects the priorities of those who are making, consuming, and preserving collections both in the past and today. So he's one of the characters. Another figure that I draw attention to is that of Matis Cilic in the fourth chapter of the book. And he is widely kind of held up in Latvia today as the first Latvian cartographer. He was a school teacher from quite a humble background. But in the 1890s in Riga, he started a publishing business to produce popular calendars. So these were kind of small books aimed at lower class readers. And he published fold-out maps that accompanied these calendars. So again, this is an example of borderland cartographic entrepreneurship, of creativity happening in indigenous vernacular languages in Latvian language in the Russian Empire, taking place outside of the imperial metropole and addressing quite a different readership. He was addressing a kind of a lower class audience of readers and consumers.
Yeah, and I think one of the big arguments, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I see, you know, really compelling in your book this argument about cartography from below and social dimensions of mapping. And here I think about some of your comments about the changes toward the mid or maybe end of the 19th century, that maps began to concentrate on things like housing or public health or urban statistics. I mean, trying to fuel information or give information to different ministries. And I guess, I'd sort of ask you about that, if you could tell us how that shaped or framed the Baltic question or questions. And I think, of course, of Holly Case's work about the 19th century as an age of questions. So I guess I wonder, since you mentioned Cilic and Latvia in the 1870s, how those questions were then created or shaped by these spatial social activists, among which you would maybe include map makers? How did they give us a Baltic question or Baltic questions through ethnographic and linguistic mapping?
So I'm really glad that you mentioned the work of Holly Case, because reading her work really made me see the maps that I was looking at, and also to revisit this debate about the Baltic question in a whole new light. So just very briefly for our listeners, the Baltic question was one of these big kind of 19th century questions that emerged, and it started after the failed Decembrist uprising of 1825, when it was a time of self-reflection, of introspection among the empire's elites, who were evaluating Peter the Great's westernizing reforms of the 18th century. And to put it very briefly, on the one hand, some of this kind of particularities of the Baltic provinces, which I mentioned earlier, meant that the region was perceived as very much being part of the West, and was used to present Russia as a true kind of European empire. On the other hand, a group of thinkers known collectively under the umbrella as the Slavophiles began to kind of question this, and to think about Russian culture as being something separate, as being distinctive and apart from the West. And in this context, the Baltic provinces seem to really kind of reaffirm some of these anxieties about the diversity of imperial populations as somehow a threat to the Russian nation and an extension of Western culture and values into Russia's borders. So bearing this in mind and very much taking inspiration from the work of Holly Case, I looked again at lots of the ethnographic maps that were being produced in the second half of the 19th century, and really began to see how these maps were kind of positioned as attempts to understand some of these questions, and also attempts to propose answers and solutions using methods of data visualization. So in chapter 3, I talk a lot and discuss the work of Alexander Rittich, who produced a series of maps which presented the Baltic provinces as very much being closely connected to the Slavic world, and to make arguments about the underlying historical connections and cultural affinities between Estonians, Latvians, and other Slavic populations.
And I guess since you mentioned Rittich, how does he compare with some of the, I don't know if you would describe them as Latvian or Latvianizing mappers, but I mean, definitely you've got a contrast between Rittich, for example, who's kind of imagining this borderland liminal space as a civilizational clash between Germans and Slavs, or at least an incorporation into empires, and then, you know, compared to, say, August and Martha Bielenstein, could you maybe tell us a bit about how the Latvians in this trans-imperial world begin syncretizing and borrowing and then creatively making their own arguments in these maps, for lack of a better word? Because I think there are a lot of arguments, given what you say, this popularization of map literacy and print culture and visual data.
Yes, that's a great question. And I think what it really comes to is all of these map makers are experimenting with how we think about different human groups and the borders between them, and on what scale we need to think about them.
Right.
So people such as Rittich He was very much a kind of advocate of and practitioner for mapping the Slavic world, and for seeing the Baltic provinces as somehow on the fault line between the German world and the Slavic world, as he would put it. The other map makers that you mentioned, so that I discuss in the book, August and Martha Bielenstein, were both Baltic Germans from Courland province. August was a local pastor, but also had a very passionate interest in Latvian ethnography and linguistics. And over the course of his career, in addition to his pastoral work, published many works, important kind of scientific works as well. But for him, he very much approached it as a way of understanding what he called his Heimat, so his homeland, his locality. He wasn't so interested in this kind of high level division between a Germanic world and a Slavic world. For him, he used mapping to try and understand the relationships at a more local level between this Baltic German high culture and socioeconomic elites, and then the local Latvian peasantry and lower class populations.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. And Martha, tell us about Martha, because one of the big arguments in your book is this kind of invisibilization of women in cartography and social and indigenous populations. So who was she? And I guess how do we bring in the stories of activists who are maybe left out of the great hero stories?
So Martha Bielenstein was August Bielenstein's eldest daughter. And if you look her up, she's not a well-known figure at all, really. But if we look at the map cartouches of her kind of famous father's works, we see this initial M. Bielenstein written as an acknowledgement on the maps, crediting her with withdrawing the maps. So paying attention to these small details actually raises lots of interesting questions about cartographic production. And delving into her story, we see that she never married. She stayed at home to care for her parents. And Martha was crucial in helping August to compile his ethnographic maps for one of his major publications, which was an atlas of the Latvian language. She drew and colored all the manuscript maps for her father. Some of her brothers also helped with various projects as well. And later in life, August actually became completely blind and came to rely on Martha almost completely for his scientific work. So for me, Martha's story reveals perhaps two big things. The first is that the late 19th century, we often think of as an age of booming print culture in the Russian Empire, and this also included maps. However, even in this age of print, we mustn't forget about manuscript maps. And actually, a large portion of people's social experiences of map making took place in manuscript form, such as through sketches on paper or drafting maps. And while many of these haven't survived or aren't catalogued in libraries, they form a kind of rather substantial part of cartographic culture and are crucial for understanding the spread of cartographic literacy and engagements with these forms of visual communication within society more broadly. And we can actually see by the historical archive of Latvia in Riga actually has one of Martha's draft maps. And there we can see actually the influence that she had on aspects such as design and color. So she definitely wasn't just a kind of assistant, but was actually kind of fundamental in the visual production of the work. But I think Martha's story, secondly, also raises important methodological questions for historians about how we can find evidence of this often invisible cartographic labor taking place. And this is where I found it helpful to engage with perspectives and approaches from history of science, which very much emphasizes kind of different places or sites of scientific production. So there's been some really interesting work by people such as Donald Opitz and Christine von Oertzen about domesticity and science in the 19th century, looking at female family members, research assistants, etc., and also the kind of gendered dimensions of paper in the history of science, and how we kind of can look for different sources and read different sources against the grain to try and tell the stories of those who might not be represented in more traditional sources or in library catalogs.
And I guess there's a big story with the history of the Latvian intelligentsia as well, and the spaces for production and consumption and communication. What, Catherine, would you suggest, if I could follow up on this a little bit, for researchers who want to examine the not just the history of science, but also this gendered dimension of cartography? Is there something special, let's say, in the Latvian or Latgalian case where let's say, you know, we can begin to look at the popularization or the aestheticization of maps and the fine details in that kind of trademark way? Is there a Latvian exceptionalism, I guess, is where I'm going with this? But what can we get out of, let's say, going to the archives or going to the special cases in the 1890s and 1900s?
I would be hesitant to say that there's so much of an exceptionalism in general when it comes to the gendered dimension. I think, though, in terms of when we talk about social class and consumers and readers of maps, where the Baltic really can challenge some of our assumptions is literacy. So in the second half of the 19th century, the inhabitants of the Baltic provinces were highly literate. It was the most literate region of the whole of the Russian Empire. And this was thanks to the system of elementary education, which was quite established in this region. And we see that also this literacy also encompassed cartographic literacy as well. So children, if we look at kind of pedagogical programs for teaching geography, for teaching history, maps featured prominently. And also for lower class adult readers, among cartographic kind of print culture, which was very prominent in newspapers or in kind of popular calendars and chapbooks, like the example I mentioned earlier of Matthias Zillinch's calendars. I think the other factor that really helped cartography to kind of flourish more broadly was also issues of censorship and the regulation of cartographic print culture. Because unlike in the Northwestern territory to the south, so the region corresponding to present day Belarus, Lithuania, where there was a ban on printing in Latin letters from the 1860s to the early 1900s, which was a kind of significant a barrier or limitation, we could say, towards map production in languages such as Lithuanian or Belarusian. The Baltic provinces were not subject to this ban. And this actually led to the visibility of Estonian and Latvian language cartography, as well as German maps, and allowed these maps to circulate to an extent that wasn't possible in other regions of the empire at the time. So I think, returning to your point about the kind of gender dimension, I think, it is a challenge to uncover the kind of archival traces or kind of materials related to those who were not the named authors on the maps, those that were involved in production. But some of the factors that I've just mentioned do perhaps mean that we have more evidence in this region than we do in other parts of the empire, simply because maps were circulating much more.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, you know, as someone who's followed your work for a long time, I love how you rewrite the story of the Ilyin cartographic firm in St. Petersburg, the commercial firm that started in 1859. So it extends in different parts of the empire. I'm also intrigued, and this is just really one small point. I was thinking about Zillinch, since you mentioned him, and how he had to stop producing the calendars in 1898, like 1 year before the Atlas of Finland was produced, which I think, you know, tells us something about patronage and scale and the priorities of empire in making certain maps featured and perhaps other individuals or groups of people less prominent. I do want to ask a question, since you did mention censorship, and I guess I'm really thinking about this in the work that I do about World War I. So your last chapter, I think, is a really fascinating one about boundary mapping, and I wonder if you could talk about Estonia. This is an invitation, really, since you're in Tartu, to get you to talk about conflicts or wars, maybe that didn't happen or that didn't break out. And here I'm thinking about the Estonian-Latvian border and the Estonian-Latvian Border Commission after the war. But tell us why Estonia becomes so important as well in this history of cartography and these cartographic legacies and quarrels.
When I was writing the book, I was kind of faced with a dilemma of do I include every map maker, or do I, you know, try and pick some case studies, so to speak, that I can kind of explore and unpack. And I know in your work as well, with your map men, that it poses a kind of similar dilemmas about how we choose to tell the stories of cartography. There's no kind of dedicated chapter in my book related to Estonian cartographies per se. But the fifth chapter that you mention, dealing with the cartographic kind of legacies and different quarrels that emerged immediately after the First World War, brings some of these different themes and issues to the fore. So after the declaration of Estonian and Latvian independence in 1919, there was a special Estonian-Latvian boundary commission established to basically agree on the border between these newly independent states. In some ways, we could argue that this was still quite hypothetical, as various conflicts in the region were still ongoing, but it was deemed to be crucial for their kind of claims to national self-determination and to kind of claim sovereignty in the region, that they had a very kind of clear idea about where the borders would be drawn. Although the two sides kind of approximately agreed on the region where the border would fall, there was fierce disputes over the finer details over how to draw a line through a region that was inhabited by a mixture of both Estonian and Latvian speaking mostly farming communities. And it really kind of pushed this discourse about drawing borders based on ethnolinguistic factors, about claiming territory based on the idea of national self-determination, to the extreme. Because the Boundary Commission, in the attempt to kind of enact an ethnolinguistic border, produced extremely detailed ethnographic maps and surveys of the border region at the scale of individual farmsteads, classifying them either as inhabited by Estonians or by Latvians. And What was, I think, especially interesting about this case is it wasn't just a top-down process. Some of the developments that I've been talking about, such as the kind of spread of cartographic literacy and the circulation of cartographic print culture within society, meant that there was an awareness among local populations about how cartography could be used to give voice to claims. And actually, the Estonian-Latvian Boundary Commission, during this period, received a kind of outpouring of petitions from the local population, some of which were also accompanied by hand-drawn maps using cartography to challenge the proposal for where the border would be drawn and to advocate for what they saw as their rights and wishes.
Yeah, and you have such good examples of this. I remember the story of Jan Karm, this complainer. I guess it's a grievance, right? But it's a petition, and it's a very logical citizen farmer complaining that the border splits his farm in two. So I guess that, now, that voice and that agency, which you rightly point out, becomes a form of counter mapping. I don't know if it's counter hegemonic mapping, but maybe you know, it becomes a tool for at least putting putting dialogues in place. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And I mean, in many ways, this isn't a kind of new phenomenon. I discussed the work of Valerie Gievelson, who has done wonderful research on the use of petition maps and maps in legal cases but in the early period, more in the early modern period, as a tool to attempt to settle land disputes. But what we see moving forward to the early 20th century is that this kind of cartographic means of communication suddenly is much more accessible to a much wider segment of society. So among the petitions, we have local farmers, we have women writing and drawing maps. And so we see that this kind of mechanism for communicating through visual visuality, through mapping, through this form of material culture, suddenly is taken up by a much wider segment of society.
Mm-hmm. And I guess my last question for you is a big philosophical question about cartography, which I've been dying to ask you, and maybe we can use this as a way to leap into the field and how you see it and critical geography and cartography, the things that you're reading. And my big question is really the philosophical one, and can anyone make a map? And I guess this is something I'm covering almost every day in the archiving work that I'm doing about the war in Ukraine. Looking back now at the history of Finnish, Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian mapping, is it true that anyone can make a map and do those maps consequently make a difference?
Yes and no is probably the way to answer this question. I think that there have to be kind of certain kind of preconditions. So one of them has to be some sort of cartographic spatial literacy that needs to be in place for someone to kind of produce something that can be read and understood by others as a map. This is why that it's only by the late 19th, early 20th century that this kind of mass phenomena of cartographic literacy, I think that we can really we say I would be hesitant, for example, to kind of trace it much earlier to make the claims that it was such a widespread phenomenon. And I think the other important point to raise is about what we think of as a map, because a lot of the time we have these preconceived ideas that, for example, a map, it has to look a certain way. It might have to be printed. It might have to be, you know, kind of circulated in certain venues, etc. And what I was trying to do with the book by also placing a lot of emphasis on these hand-drawn manuscript maps was to show that you don't need a large amount of money. You don't need a sponsor, a funder. You don't need a printing press. You don't need to be skilled in chromolithography, printing technology. That as it is today, that if you have this kind of cartographic literacy, then there are varying kind of means through which you can make maps. So in the case of the farmers in the Latvian Estonian border region after the First World War, if they had access to a piece of paper and a pencil, perhaps also some colored pencils or something, they could produce a map. And just like today, if we think about all of these kind of citizen science projects and online tools where people can contribute to various kind of crowdsourcing mapping projects. I think we can see a kind of similar shift in that you don't need to be trained in surveying and technical drawing to make a map now. Also with digital technologies, there are lots of ways in which we can also become map makers as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I think about the famous story, Catherine, of Woodrow Wilson from the inquiry with their 1,200 maps, spreading out the maps on the floor and trying to determine the Polish border. Obviously, there are other tools, and you don't necessarily have to master ArcGIS or story maps. Today, there's a history of data viz and spatial relationships that certainly are part of the age of nationalism and imperialism, but precede the digital universe, right? Back in analog land. Could you recommend some books for us here at New Books Network? And, we're hoping that a lot of interested people will hear you out. What are you reading, or what might you suggest to our audience?
So, in terms of books that have been particularly influential for my own work, I'm going to divide them into two categories. The first would be for people interested in histories, new histories of the Baltic provinces within the Russian Empire. And I have two books I'd like to mention. The first one is actually in German. It's by Carsten Brüggemann, called Licht und Luft des Imperiums, so the light and air of the empire. And it is an attempt to really understand these different ways among the Russian imperial elite of imagining the Baltic provinces in the 19th and early 20th century. So if you can read German, I highly recommend you check it out. The other new book is by Siobhan Hearn, Policing Prostitution, which is a really innovative social history of the region. And it's a wonderful example of how the history of the Baltic provinces can be written, drawing on archival material from a wide range of different archives, both archives in the Imperial Center in St. Petersburg and Moscow, but also local archives in Tartu, in Riga, in Liepāja, in Latvia. I recommend if you're interested in learning more about the Baltic provinces to check those two out. And in terms of recent books about cartography, one of my favorites is by Candice Fujikane. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but it's called Mapping Abundance for a Planetary Future. And she really draws on various different approaches from indigenous studies, etc., to look at this. And she had this concept of mapping abundance. And for me, this was really illuminating to also understand strategies for mapping, making by Estonians and Latvians and the Russian Empire to present a flourishing national territory that was apart from Russian imperialist influences and ambitions in the region, and also German claims as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for those. Those are great recommendations. And at Fujikane, I'm thinking about how she describes Hawaiian communities. And it was a pleasure actually to interview Siobhan Hearn as well about her book. And I hope our listeners will follow through and read these and check out the blog Peripheral Histories, if I can give a quick plug to that. I know that you and she have been both involved in that. So I wanted to thank you, Dr. Catherine Gibson, for this conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a very long time. And I wanted to mention the book again. The book we've been talking about is called Geographies of Nationhood, Cartography, Science, and Society in the Russian Imperial Baltic, authored by Catherine Gibson, published by Oxford University Press, 2022. Congratulations to you on this beautiful book once again.
And thank you, Stephen, for your time and also for the wonderful questions today.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here at New Books in East European Studies, New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, and New Books Network. Until next time.